Blog Talk Radio.
Have you ever wondered why? Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Bichette. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Wednesday, March 6th, 2024. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are available absolutely free through the tireless efforts of Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice on the website at whyagain.org. If you go to that website and click on the two words that say start here in the upper left-hand corner, it will take you to a page where you can download and read chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of the book contains a narrative description and explanation of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. And it's a tool I've been using to great effect for over 19 years now to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships and to turn any negative emotional experience I have into part of the infallible guidance system that each and every one of us has been given. You can also download the actual worksheet process itself. It's a simple PDF file. Click the link, download it, print it off, copy it as often as you'd like, and use it over and over again, absolutely free. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words, Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness. And if you choose to do that, before you're done typing the word forgiveness, you'll see the glowing heart icon. If you tap on that, it will let you download a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet. It contains an abbreviated version of that worksheet process. And it contains a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. We hope people do all of that soon and often, primarily because it tends to improve the quality of people's lives the more they actively apply these tools in their lives. And secondarily, because it tends to prompt comments, questions, answers, and testimonials. If you have any of those to share with us, we would appreciate you doing so by giving us a call at 563-999-3581. Once you call that number, if you press 1 on your phone, it will put the little icon of a hand by your phone number. I can turn on the microphone then and announce you by your area code. And then we can have a conversation. If you choose not to call, but you'd like to get some feedback or offer some feedback, you can email us. You can email me at tjh@mindshifters-academy.org. You can email Jeannie at jeannie@whyagain.org. That's whyagain.org. And if we get a comment or a question from you through the email, we will address it on the internet show, and then as time allows, send you a notification about what day and time that occurred, so you can listen back to the archives for your feedback. And we greatly appreciate whenever anybody chooses to do that, because it makes it far easier for us to live into our intention with this work. The intention we have with this work is to be a service, And that's just a lot easier to do when we know how these things are landing for you. So if you'll take the time to share with us what's working, what's helping, what is helping you understand how to use these tools more effectively in your life, that is our purpose. And we would appreciate it. Again, call-in number is 563-999-3581. And if you call that number and press 1, we can have a conversation. Area code 541, you're in the air. How can we support you?
Good morning, Dr. Tim. This is Celinda.
Hello, Celinda.
I've been listening to all of your shows, appreciating every single moment of all the shows. I consider it my church time, 5 days a week. Larry rolls his eyes, bless his heart, and he's doing his work his way. I'm really interested in this Dr. Gruder's website and a little bit, part of which I missed yesterday morning when you were talking about his special website and what his special, he feels his special purpose is and how we could help participate in that. Could you explain that a little bit more or just repeat some of the information for me? Kind of flesh it out a bit.
Well, the area that he's working on is, the project is called the Center for Enlightened Self-Sovereignty. And that makes really good sense when you hear him talk about how our founding fathers understood that individual liberty was only valid if we could understand that individual liberty without work for the common good is narcissism, and a common good without acknowledgement of individual liberty is tyranny. Does that make sense?
Exactly, because I have come to that conclusion myself, even in a political sense and a communal sense, and even in my personal life, as being a grandiose narcissist 3-year-old for most of my life and coming out of that, recovering from that, that really relates to me. It just really hit me in the solar plexus in a very positive way.
So in the interview, he talks about how the founding fathers knew there had to be a balance between individual liberty and pursuit of the common good. And we've fallen away from that. And in the first interview we did yesterday, that dropped yesterday, he talks about the 5 or 6 ways that we've gotten off track. And then in an interview that will drop next Tuesday, he talks about how he thinks we can correct that. And one of the things he talked about is that in both the last 2 presidencies, one was a Republican and one was Democratic, when asked if they thought the country was moving in the right direction, 80-some percent of the people said no. So he's talking about how the system itself is not working effectively. He's not picking sides and saying this political party is right and that political party is wrong. He's saying we have a serious problem where it doesn't matter which party we put in power, our citizens are saying it isn't working well. So he created this project and he's launched it. It is it is still just being, launched. It isn't like a full-fledged thing. But in this first level of launching this project, which he calls the Center for Enlightened Self-Sovereignty, it's free. And people can go to his website at thecess.com, and they can start exploring how they might help. They might help the project. They might help themselves. They might build some skills that will help them be a contributing factor in whatever solution we arrive at. Because, you know, he's saying, you got a problem, and the first step in solving a problem is accurately defining what is the problem and or what are the root causes of the problem. If you can't do that, he says, then whatever attempts you make to solve the problem are probably going to at least be inefficient, if not be completely ineffective.
So, or even harmful, possibly.
Right. So if you go to that website, thecess.com, you can explore what's up so far, and if you choose, you can, you know, log in and get some information and see what he's proposing as a series of steps that people can start to engage in as a process to try to define and then create some solutions for our problems.
I am so,
is that an answer to your question?
Beautiful, because I am so, that's right down the alley that I have been exploring. And I would be excited to participate in that, not only for the communal good, but for my own and our little family. And also, I have Larry and I are reading The Divided Mind by John Sarno. It was his last book, Dr. John Sarno. And I see where it so lines up with the Aramaic gospel forgiveness, except for two things that I perceive differently. One, it seems like he's saying we're all victims and there's nothing we can do about it. And two, he stops with the emotion and he never gets to the thought that creates a perception that, and then the thought and the emotion together that the thought and the perception together or whatever it is that creates the emotion itself. So I'm just loving the way all these things, and thank you for presenting so much of this, are coming together for me. It's very sweet. And these are the two On Your Mind podcasts. Is that correct?
Yes. You can
and
find them at, well,
go ahead.
It is yesterday's, and it will be next week's.
Okay. Perfect. Beautiful. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
For your participation. And I was really pleased to hear Anne's voice the other day. I've kind of thought of her frequently on and off, and I wonder what's happening with Anne. I miss her voice and your dialogue with yours and Michael's both dialogue with Susan. She's going through this potato patch, what's called a potato patch to sailors at this moment with her grandson. And I'm just learning from it all. Thank you, because our son died from alcoholism. So there's just a whole bunch of interesting things. I'm also doing a fourth step inventory with one of with an AA member, and I am finding a lot of resistance to the languaging, but working around that to see what I can learn from that process. So I feel like I'm opening up like a little bud that's been afraid to come out in the cold. It's just unfolding.
All right. All right, well, welcome to the unfolding. Is there anything else we can support you with at this time?
No. Have you had experience with two-way prayer or the God letters? and Letters from God process that's apparently from the Oxford group, which was the foundation for AA in the very beginning?
Yes. What's the question about that? Presented it as done by Glennon Doyle and her team on their podcast. We presented it as something that has been called, I think it's Letters from Love that Liz Gilbert refers to it as. And and she invites people to practice it. She's been doing it daily for over 20 years. And so is there a specific question you have about this?
I was just wondering if you had explored it personally or any of your clients, and what your feedback was, what your experience was, either from somebody else's experience of relating to it, resonating with it, or if you yourself had ever.
Well, I've done it in the past. I haven't done any of it recently. It can be a very powerful tool. I've done it from what you might call a very secular perspective, the psychological perspective, where people would say, okay, so just pretend that when you write down a significant question about what's going on in your life, that you'll get an answer, and the answer will come from someplace other than your conscious logical mind. And one way to facilitate that is write the answer with your non-dominant hand. And so I've done that kind of thing in the past in my psychological training and in different venues where I've worked with kids and families and things. So it can be a very productive exercise. That's about all I can tell you at this point.
Well, I'm playing with it, so I thought I would ask. And I like what you say about writing it in the answer in your non-dominant hand, which would be a real challenge for me and perhaps for many others. But it certainly would slow my head down, I think.
Well, it has been known over the generations to be a way to help bypass the conscious logical process.
Sweet. And also, I would reference that when I took the Touch for Health many years ago, 30-some years ago, one of the things they equated or mentioned was that printing fell in the domain of the left brain, and writing fell in the script, cursive, fell in the domain of the right brain. And that's why this writing, apparently research has shown that typing something on a typewriter or printing something does not engage the right brain. And I was thinking about that in relation to the school systems in the U.S. of being cursive totally and only focusing on computer and printing. And the elementary schools aren't even teaching cursive anymore from the feedback I get from teachers. And so do you have any comments about that?
Sure. If you want them, just get small bills, unmarked bills, put them in a brown paper bag, and I'll text you the drop-off point for that.
Sounds wonderful. I'm waiting for the text.
If you get in touch with brain researchers, they will tell you, yes, this has definitely had an impact on how our brains develop. And if you tune into the book, The Brain That Can Change Itself, they talk specifically about that, about how back in the 60s, up until the 60s, there was a lot of emphasis on very precise writing and tracing of letters in script. and very, very long rote memorization of poems, sometimes in a different language, and how this gave rise to an entirely different level of development of the brain and probably helped a number of people who would have had learning disabilities because it forced the weaker parts of their brain to function and get stronger and or larger and more effective. And so, you know, all of these things that we do, especially when we're younger, that require us to stretch, you know, work harder, memorize, write in cursive, et cetera, it makes the brain grow. It makes the brain function differently. It challenges the brain to expand in different ways. And that specific thing about dropping rote memorization and writing in cursive out of the lesson plan in our education system has definitely had an impact on how our brains develop.
Well, you've just given me another clue in relation to my brain and my inability to access certain parts of it. And that is that when I was a small child, I remember in the second grade, I was in a play and of Wizard of Oz, and I was supposed to be a turnip and say my lines on stage. And I wouldn't do that because I didn't have anybody else, so I had to be changed into a carrot. And then when I was in the fourth grade, I was to memorize the poem If by Rudyard Kipling. And I memorized it and thought I'd memorized it really well. And my stepmom kept saying, you better practice some more or you're going to forget it when you get up there. And lo and behold, I forgot it when I got up there and was very humiliated and had to be prompted to do the rest of it. And I've noticed it has had an impact on my ability to memorize long passages or to even sort out on a test all of the factors because I just don't quote-unquote see them, that would lead to a quote-unquote right answer as versus a wrong answer. And so this is very, very interesting.
Well, you would enjoy books like The Brain That Can Change That Changes Itself. And that author has some other books as well. His name is Norman Doidge, Doidge. And he has more than one book about the brain. The Brain That Changes Itself is one, and The Brain's Way of Healing is another. He may have others, but those are two that I'm aware of.
Great.
And I've been talking about some of those things. I talked a little bit about it yesterday on the internet show, that the brain is so flexible and capable of change and actually healing itself, fixing itself, growing in different ways that they go directly against what the prevailing ideas of medical science would have told us even just a few decades ago. And so, you know, if you're looking for, it even came up in the support group last night, I used some of that research that I was learning about in that book to highlight how actively we choose our perception. And our internal experience of life isn't happening anywhere but inside of us. And we think we're looking out our eyes and seeing stuff out there, but we're not. What we're doing is creating an image. And we're creating an image because light waves bounce off of whatever's outside, whatever energy's outside of us. And if those light waves are intercepted by our eyes, the light waves stimulate neural passageways. And in the normal healthy brain, that stimulates a segment of the brain near the base in the rear. We call it the occipital lobe. And that then prompts our brain to show us a picture, an image, a guess about what's really going on in the world outside of us. And for a lot of time, a lot of years, we thought, well, that's it. The only way for us to see is to have eyes and to have light hit the eyes and have these nerves stimulate a certain part of the brain, et cetera. But they've proven over and over again in animal studies and in human studies that different parts of the brain can generate images, and people can generate images about what's going on outside of themselves even if they have no eye functioning from birth. Congenitally blind people have been able to see with devices that convert light from a camera into electrical currency and then stimulate the skin on the back or the abdomen of an individual, and that person can actually get images in their brain about what's going on outside of them. So if you're looking for any kind of validation to the idea that Way of Mastery talks about, that, you know, you are creating your experience of life, there's hard science validation to most of this stuff.
Wow, that shows me how powerful my mind is if I say this is the way it is or that's the way I am. We're basically shutting the door to...
You create a prison. You don't just shut a door. You build a prison, you lock it, and you throw away the key.
Sounds like
our
unconscious.
You don't just shut a door. Yep. One of the dynamics that does that is the unconscious, yes. But the other, you know, dynamic is that we are creating our experience of life. So another way that it says it in the Way of Mastery is what you decree is. And so if you say, that's just the way I am, then it's going to stay just that way. You are going to stay just that way because you decreed it to be so, not because it was created that way and there's no way to grow or change. It's going to stay that way because you're demanding, you're decreeing, you're creating that actuality for yourself by refusing to entertain options.
Thank you for all these links you're giving me.
You're welcome and deserving. Anything else we can help you with today?
I think that's a full plate, don't you?
All right. I will mute you so you can listen to the rest of this hour and the second hour. Thank you for that series of comments and input. And we have plenty of time for more comments, questions, answers, testimonials, 563-999-3581. If you call that number and press 1 as Celinda did, we can have a conversation. What is on your mind? You know, as I just mentioned in the support group last night, we listened to another of the Darshans from Lesson 9 in the Way of Mastery. And Lesson 9 in the Way of Mastery highlights, the title of the lesson is All Events Are Neutral. And that's quite a challenge for a lot of people to enter the playground and say, okay, all events are neutral. Area code 760, you're in the air.
Hi, Dr. Tim. This is Anne.
Hello, Anne.
So, in light of what you were just saying about the brain, so would it also be that when we start reading things that are different than what we were brought up with, you know, like we start thinking outside the box, like I've listened to you and Michael's show for years now, and it has inspired me to read things differently than the church teachings I was brought up in. And yet I still hold to those, but yet it's like it's opened up my mind.
What do you mean you hold to those? What does that mean?
I still believe in what I was brought up to in the church.
And what is that you believe?
Like, well, believing in God and believe that in Yeshua that he came to save us from ourselves, I guess, in a way, I could say. And I don't know if it's, I don't call it religion, just, I don't know. But on the show, you've presented different ways, so I just spent a couple hours reading a book that I'd gone to a seminar here in Gainesville, a professor that teaches some of the, I guess it's India, the Vedic terms he puts on communication, but it's a lot of what Michael and what you guys talk about and communication and responsibility communication and just all the stuff that I've learned through, you know, Michael and Michael's work. David Wolfe, transformative communication can change your life. Well, a lot of what I've learned through Michael's work and listening to you on your part of the show is, you know, been transformative too. So anyway, but reading this book and putting called Vedic, an Indian term, and other words. And it's like, okay, I don't have to change my belief system to still get something out of something that's different than what I was brought up with. I don't know if I'm making sense. But.
Well, that last statement you made, you don't have to change the beliefs that you were brought up with in order to do what?
In order to be open to other ways of thinking. So like the
okay,
way
so you don't have to change what you believe from what you were brought up with in order to be open to other ways of thinking. I'm happy for you if you're finding that to be the case. It sounds a bit contradictory, but if it's working for you, then just let it work for you.
Okay. I think I'm not putting it the way I'm thinking it, but
well, the thing is, when we talk about belief in this work, you know,
right.
and this is right, just staying very, very close to A Course in Miracles and Way of Mastery, belief is an old, dead thought. If you're acting, living from belief, you're not living from the flow of life. You're not eyes wide open, connected to what's happening in the moment. You're living, as Michael would say, from the past, because belief is thought.
Oh, okay.
Right?
Okay.
And thought is old stuff. My thoughts are not arising in the moment. They're being resonated by what the Way of Mastery would call the intellect, which has been shoved full of trivialities like garbage in a garbage can.
Okay.
And so belief is, according to the observations that we make here, nowhere near as effective or preferable as living by direct observation. I often, when I'm trying to introduce this to people in a therapy session, and it's usually in the first few sessions, I say, look, how do you drive your car?
Oh.
You drive your car from direct observation. You don't drive your car from belief in any way, shape, or form. And then I usually turn my they're sitting directly in front of me, and I turn my chair so I'm facing, you know, 90 degrees away from them. And they get to see me act as though I have my hands on the wheel out in front of me, and I turn my head up and to the left, And I say, now I can visualize that the road is straight and clear and all the lights are green, and if I floor it, I'll get home sooner. And I push my foot down like I'm flooring the gas pedal. And usually that gets a chuckle out of people because there's no way you would drive a car that way. You keep your eyes out in front where the car will be going, and you let the truth of what's happening there act on you. You don't just drive based on the rules of the road. What do you mean, Dr. Tim? I mean, the rules of the road say if I approach an intersection and the light is green, I have the right of way. But if I approach the road and the intersection and the light is green and there's a group of school kids or a blind person halfway through the intersection, I don't just say, well, I guess I'll just go through because I have the right of way. I let the truth of what's happening there act on me. And I can't do that if I'm acting from the belief that says, well, I have a right of way. That's what I was taught.
Okay. Got ya.
So yeah. I use a lot of my mind energy ever since I learned this probably about 30, 40 years ago. I use a lot of my mind energy, and I use it to watch my words, and I speak and try to think and try to live from direct observation rather than belief or dogma or shoulds. That's another way that we talk about this. And I was raised in the Catholic Church with all kinds of beliefs and dogmas. And I was raised to believe that if I didn't adhere to these beliefs, horrible consequences were going to befall me.
Right.
You know, purgatory, hell.
Right.
You know, all kinds of eternal punishment at the time of death, etc. So that's why when somebody says, I can adhere to the old beliefs and still entertain new things, it just doesn't register very solidly in my mind. It might be possible for them.
That's like an oxymoron, kind of.
It seems that way to my mind. I don't know, because I can't make sense of it in my mind. That doesn't mean there's no way to do it.
Right. Okay.
But that's why the Way of Mastery in Lesson 3 talks about dismantling perception and judgment. Every judgment, every perception. Now, it says it differently, but there's a line in the Course in Miracles, I'm told, where it says perception was made as an attack on God. And it took me quite a while to make any sense of that. But eventually, when I listened to it enough, I questioned people like Dr. Michael Rice, who talked about it. Eventually, they arrived at, and I was able to understand it, the way of Mastery talks about it. My perception is just a set of thoughts and images I have about what is actually happening in the world outside of me. It's not the truth. It's my brain's, like if you talk about Anil Seth and his video on perception and hallucinating perception, he says, we don't see anything outside of us. Our brain just makes its best guess about what's going on outside of us. We are all actually hallucinating our reality all the time.
So that goes back to that research that you were just talking about too.
Yes.
With the blind person. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
In many ways, it's getting validated by hard science research that, you know, no light enters into our cranial cavity. Our brain isn't seeing light images. Our brain is just receiving electrical impulses from the nerves that are connected to the cornea that get stimulated by light. So in the third lesson of the Way of Mastery, it says, you know, what we're asking people to do with forgiveness. We're teaching this tool of forgiveness. It's a tool to dismantle every judgment and every perception.
Okay, so then, all right. So I'm just going to relanguage what I said. So it's more like, okay, I've become more open to looking at things differently from the way I was brought up. Because I can learn to be in the present. I'm still practicing that. It takes a lot of work when dismantling old beliefs. I mean, I wouldn't have ever wanted to even pick up anything different than what I, you know, the other than the Bible when I was the way I was brought up. But now, and my mom, who knows? I can't judge that she'd be turning over in her grave, but for me to pick up, you know, this, even go to the seminar that Dr. Wolf had and then pick up that book today about communication and then say, wow, this sounds a lot like, you know, what Michael's been teaching, and get that connection and go, yeah. And I feel okay about it. I mean, there's not anybody coming to, you know, strike me on the hand or something because I picked up something different. But I can still believe in things that I've been taught through the Bible too. So I don't know. That makes sense.
Well, if it makes sense to you, that's fine. That's all that matters. How are you making sense of your world and in a way that is leading you to be able to, in this work, we would say, leading you to be able to choose for love more and more often in your life.
Yes, which is what's happening. Okay. Now, thanks for reining me in. Yeah, sometimes, and it is the language. It is just, how we put it out there. Okay.
Well,
thank
and I talk about, you know, I did a talk once. They were asking me to talk at a Unity church years ago, and I had a piece of a story from Guy Finley that I had expanded, and embellished, and then it grew, and so finally I put it into a talk at the Unity church, and it was a talk about the benefit. The tremendous benefit about living your life from direct observation as opposed to belief. And there was a story about a land once upon a time on a planet where there was very little solid ground. And it was like, you know, these little tiny islands in a sea of acidic, toxic sludge. And these people had discovered, you know, thousands of years before, a substance that was sludge, toxic, acidic, resistant substance, and they had milled it to get it to this fine, you know, like a mylar balloon type thing, right? And so, that material was in short supply, so when you got to a certain age, you were given two of these kind of like inflated pillows, balloons, that you could step on one carrying the other one, and then you could put the second one down in whatever direction you wanted to go on top of this toxic sludge, and you could step on it and then reach behind you and pick up the other one and then put it down where you wanted to go. And that way you could travel anywhere you wanted in any direction on top of this toxic sludge. And because it was in, relatively rare and short supply, babies were carried by their parents, children were carried by their parents until they reached the age where they were responsible enough to care for these balloon things. And eventually, to make them more aesthetically pleasing, they made them in the shape of leaves. So everybody would have two balloon leaves that they would use to get around. Every time they left a building and got to the edge of their little land and they wanted to walk over to another building or another piece of land, they would have to put the balloon leaf down in the direction they wanted to go, step on it, and then drop the second one in that direction, reach behind them, pick up the first one. You get the idea? You can only go where your balloon leaves have been placed, right?
Right.
And one of the things about this, living in this culture, was that people were all, whenever they were outdoors, they were always at high alert, because if a storm came up or a wind or whatever, it was not going to be a good thing. So people were very, very careful about watching the weather and only going out when it was calm and all that good stuff, and staying very close to the parts of land that they had developed. But they also knew that there was, you know, bigger expanses of this, of like the sea of toxic sludge and whatever. And there were rumors that at the edge of the sea there was solid land, but, you know, they know it's thousands of years. They've got all of the lore. They've got all of the teachings that say anybody who ever steps on solid ground, they're never seen from again. So in this culture, there was a young woman who, you know, every once in a while somebody comes along and they push the limits and they're adventurous and they're creative and they question everything. And so she got some of her friends to go with her, and they would go further and further out from what was the normally accepted patterns of traveling on their balloon leaves. And then eventually her friends wouldn't want to go with her because they're getting nervous, and you know, you're going too far out and whatever. So one day she went out on her own, because the last few times she'd been out with her friends, she was pretty certain that the closer they got to this forbidden territory, the solid ground with all the sharp rocks and everything, the treachery there is that if you ever got too close and stepped on that or got your balloon leaf too close to that sharp rock, if it punctured one of your balloon leaves, you'd be stranded, right? Because you can't move if you don't have two balloon leaves, one to stand on and one to reach behind and pick up and put in the right direction. And if you were right. that far out, you might die before somebody came along to rescue you. But she had this sense that the closer she got to this territory, the more she felt like she was hearing something, almost like, you know, the buzzing of bees or something in the distance. But the more they looked, the more she looked, the more she just saw nothing. It was just this barren land with this treacherous rock surface. But this one day, she just pushed the limits. And try to imagine the terror here. She's going against thousands of years of lore in her village and her world, really, and the teachings of all the elders. And she gets closer and closer to the edge. And then, because nothing terrible happens, and the kind of the buzzing noise gets louder, and no matter how she scans as she's standing there on her balloon leaves, which, you know, that's a lot to say, balloon leaf. So the people in her culture had abbreviated it to B-leaf, L-E-A-F. And as she stood there on her belief, she couldn't see anything, but the noise seemed kind of a feeling in her chest like there was something going on. So she did something that no one had done for hundreds of generations. She got so close to the edge that she put her next balloon leaf, down on solid ground. And it didn't pop right away. So then she did the most insane thing anybody had ever done in thousands of generations. She stepped off of her balloon leaf onto the balloon leaf on the ground. And it didn't pop. And then, miracle of miracles, she stepped off of her bee leaf onto solid ground. And in the instant she did that, hands appeared and grabbed her, picked her up, cheering. There were crowds of people there. They came out of nowhere. She had just been standing there staring. And it was a good thing she was a young person or she would have died of a heart attack. And they picked her up and carried her like she was some kind of a goddess and chanting and cheering. And there were musical instruments and there were campgrounds. And as she sat there in total shock and disbelief, and they put a blanket around her, and one of the elder women, wise woman, was, you know, urging her, here, take a little sip of this broth, et cetera. And when she finally started to get her senses about her, she said to the elderly woman, how could this be? There was nothing here. All this came out of nowhere. And the older woman said, my dear, we have always been here waiting for one of you to step off of your beliefs onto solid ground where you're open to seeing the truth of what's here. We've always been here. But you can't see us as you're traveling around on your beliefs.
I've heard you tell that before, but for some reason, I guess the brain cells are in a different place this time. I got one more piece of it to understand it. So it's almost like, I know at one of the intensives, Michael's intensive, I'm getting the picture of when he put on the board that he had the outline of the body like he'll do with the stick figure. And then in the center in the trunk, he drew a squiggly line, and then he put hearts underneath it. And it's like, okay, that love in us has always been there, and we just go about uncovering it. And it makes me think of that. So my openness to reading other things other than what I was brought up to, I guess, is like, okay, it's like stepping on that solid ground. It's opening up more things for me. So,
yes.
Thanks for telling that story again, though, because that's what it's about. I don't have to stay in that, the old stuff. And it's okay. Nobody's going to. It's kind of like you're saying, well, at the end of the story, there's people that cheer me on, right? Because I open up and let love show more, and because I'm no better than I am. Very cool. Okay. Thank you. Appreciate you.
You're entirely welcome and deserving. I appreciate the call and the comments. Anything else we can support you in today?
No, but thank you for continuing to reread stuff and just learn the different stuff that you do.
Blessings. Thank you for the call. And thank you, Celinda, for your comments and questions earlier. I will I'll look forward to feedback, Celinda, if you explore some of those books on the brain that can heal itself or change itself and see how that meshes with what you experience as you allow yourself to live more in the direct observation and to question everything. So there's the other thing. A lot of times when I talk about this, people say, well, what do you mean live in direct observation? A simple way to talk about it is the way Rilke talks about how we need to learn to live in the question without demanding an answer. And that is something that most of us in the Western world find an insane assignment. It just seems like gobbledygook. What do you mean, living in the question without demanding an answer or wanting an answer? Because everything in the Western world is built on having made the intellect the master, having moved, you know, the conscious logical mind and science and logic and elevating it to the level of master. Whereas, as Einstein said, it was only always and ever designed to be a faithful servant, a useful tool to pick up from time to time and put down when we're done with it. And what was intended to be the precious gift, the way we were intended to relate to most of our life experiences, is through the intuitive mind. You might call it in this way, the Way of Mastery calls it the awakened heart. And so as Rilke is pointing out, when we learn to live in the question, we're wide open, we're saying, I don't know, I'm willing to learn, etc., then we give ourselves the space to have life experiences with humility and grace, and then our mind, our brain can grow and stretch and expand. And as Rilke says, we might then live along someday into an answer. Because the mind that asks a really good question in that same moment is not even capable of comprehending the answer to that really good question. And so that's exactly what the Way of Mastery is calling us to do. What the Reality Management Worksheet is calling us to do is cancel everything we think we want, cancel everything we think we know, and ask to be shown something else. Ask to be shown how to live, how to relate to the world, how to be in the present moment from a higher level of wisdom, a higher level of integration, you know, multiple levels of input that go beyond the five physical senses. And if we're willing to do that, we have the capacity to experience life in a way that goes beyond words each new heartbeat. So that's what we're here to support people in doing. That's what we're called to do with the Way of Mastery. That is a process that has been more beneficial in my life than words can say over the last 30 or so years, and even more specifically in the last 20 years since encountering these tools, the Reality Management Worksheet, etc. So thank you all for being here and listening. I'll remind us all that we come from love. We're made of the stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. Welcome, Jeannie Rice.
Thank you. What was the story you were reading about the falling off the bee leaf?
Well, it's a story I made up and expanded based on a little piece from Guy Finley years ago. It's a story I've told before. It isn't actually written anywhere, but I have it in different audio files and presentations I've made at, like, Unity churches and things.
Well, I like it. Do you have it on the Academy site?
I'll look it up. I'll try and now that it's come up a couple times in the past couple months, I'll try and get a good recording and upload it here so I can have some consistency in it.
All right. Thanks. I enjoyed listening to it.
I'm glad to hear it. Thank you. And have a great show.
All right, thanks. So welcome, everybody, to the second hour of Mindshifters Radio. And today is Wednesday, March the 6th, 2024. And our call-in number is 563-999-3581. And press 1, and that puts you into queue to talk to us. And, Michael, I see that your caller is already on whenever you're ready.
Sweet. Welcome, everybody. Delighted that you're here. I just caught a little bit, if you're still around, Tim, of your story about getting off your belief. And I'm not sure what all the commentary made, but the piece that I heard, what it resonated for me is the surrender of perception. Are we willing to give up these constructs of carbon-based memory that convince us of all kinds of things that are based in absolute fantasy, generational patterns and such? So delighted. And Miss Joan, you're with us. How are you, young lady?
I'm good. Can you hear me?
You are loud and clear. Delight to hear your voice.
Okay. Thank you.
I've been waiting for days with bated breath for you to return.
Well, my question has to do with tapping and the field work that you taught us about pressure points.
Right,
the
energy field work.
And how to do that with somebody that we're supporting their still point breathing. How
right.
Are those points related to tapping?
There may be some coincidental similarities with the tapping and the energy field work that we teach in the Why Is This Happening to Me Again intensive and teacher training, but no, there's no direct correlation between the two. The energy field work is something that I've developed over the last almost 50 years. There are probably 30 different seminars that I've done. And in particular, when I first discovered still point breathing and realized the importance and the depth of still point breathing, what I started to look for in the studies I was doing and the different seminars I would do on physical, mental, emotional medicine, I would look specifically for anything that would induce still point in people. And then I would incorporate that in the energy field work, because the still point is really where it all happens. And in fact, I had a young man who's been with us actually for a couple of days. I did, and this is something I haven't done for almost four decades, but I did a one-on-one personal mini intensive over a three-day period here. And the intensity of doing, you know, that direct work and moving into still point on deeper levels than just the mind is, you know, really profound. So I'd kind of forgotten how much fun it was to take somebody into that deep estate. In fact, I've been talking with Jeannie about maybe we'll make that part of what we do here while we're in Virginia is that I'll do one-on-one intensives, three-day intensive programs with people. But we're sort of talking about that right now. But there's no direct relationship there. But I did have another piece to offer to your question on Friday about how if I do my work, what's the impact that I can have on another's life, someone that I'm related to, and or even someone who's passed? And my take, an analogy. Go ahead.
The former husband. And I,
right.
I'm encountering some relationship issues with my younger son. And of course, I don't want him to inherit my dysfunctional pattern, so I work on mine. And I'm wondering, as I heal myself, how does that have an impact on my son's father, who's deceased?
Right.
So that my son has the advantage of his healing also.
Right. Well, if you think in terms of energy, and remember the primary rule of energy is resonance. And resonance has to do with how matching energy fields exchange energy. You know, if I take a middle C tuning fork and I hit it on a desk and I put it near a second middle C tuning fork, that second tuning fork doesn't have any choice. there's just a pure energy exchange that is going to change the action of the second tuning fork. Now, if I put a middle A tuning fork in front of that middle C, it doesn't matter how hard I hit it or how often, it's not going to create any impact on the middle A tuning fork because they're in different frequency ranges. So my take would be that, you know, there's probably a good chance that your son has some of the energy dynamics genetically of dad, or not a chance, it's definitely there. And there's a good chance there might be some power person dynamics that he acquired through his relationship with dad. And of course, power person dynamics tend to be generational, and probably a good chance that some of those power person dynamics that his dad had played out in your relationship with him. So anything that you haven't resolved or that he hasn't resolved would tend to play out at some point, because again, it's not a matter of choice. It's not a matter of, I can't say, oh, well, I'm never going to go near that. If this energy moves in someone else and I have a match, I don't have a choice. It's going to move in me. My choice is, what do I do with it? Do I, you know, blame? Do I own it? Do I process through it? Do I use the tools to clean it up? And in terms of how would it impact someone else in the family system or someone who's passed, sort of an analogy for understanding it. I mean, I can't force somebody else to heal an issue, even though I've chosen to face that issue and process through it myself. However, energetically, if I do my deeper work around a given issue, the energy field that I have in relationship to them shifts and opens a space. And a good understander, a good way to explain it, or what I've come up with to explain it, is let's imagine that, you know, we've all probably had a house with a basement, and there was a basement door, and that old basement door is corroded around the bottom, and there's been water in it, and there've been bugs in it, and a dozen people have tried to get that door open, but nobody's strong enough, and nobody knows how to do anything about it, so that door just stays that way for years. And one day, someone comes along with the skills and the willingness to clean out the track, replace the wheels, lubricate the door so that instead of, you know, you almost have to break your back to open the door, you can just use a finger or two and slide the door open. So if everybody in the family has gone down and tried to open that door, but nobody's ever been successful, and I clean the tracks, I make the door easily manageable, then anybody who comes to that door is going to be able to open it. So while I can't force another to go through it, if I've done the work, it's kind of like I've lubricated the pathway, and it's going to be easier for that person to move through that energy. Whether they're in their bodies or not, it doesn't matter. I don't know if you've been on a show where I talked about, about a year and a half ago, I was just by myself and I was doing a still point session, and I'm laying there with my eyes closed, and I had the instruction as I'm breathing away. There was kind of, you know, some energy moving, and I'm breathing away, and I had the instruction to look down, which I thought was kind of strange. I mean, I'm laying there with my eyes closed. I turned my eyes down. What am I going to see? But I followed the instruction, and as I turned my eyes down, what I could see, and of course it wasn't physical, but what I saw in my mind was a huge field of darkness, like a field so broad, so long, so huge, I could hardly imagine it. And in that field, there were an uncountable number of small white lights, all surrounded in darkness. And the number was like unfathomable. I could have never counted them. And so I'm breathing away, and I see this, and I ask, it's like, what am I looking at? And what I was told is, these are my ancestors, this that they're still carrying, that they're living in. And they are asking you if you will be willing to take on the energy of that darkness and help to process through it, which for me felt like it was a huge privilege and an honor to easily and instantly say yes. And I actually, when I responded, I mean, I was literally asked that question, and I mean, I'm breathing away, I'm by myself in the room, and I answered out loud. I said yes. And the instant that I said yes, my phone rang. Usually when I do a still point session, I've got my phone off. This day I didn't turn it off. And my phone rang. It was beside me, so I reached over and I answered it. And it was my son, Michael J. Now, at that point, my son is, I don't know, 42 or 43. So in 43, he doesn't know my family really well, my personal family, because they were up in Canada and we were down here. We went up there a few times when he was small, but, you know, he didn't have a real connection with too many of the family members. And we'd never had any conversation about ancestry or anything like that. But as I replied that I was willing to process this darkness of my ancestors, Michael J. rings my phone. He says, "Hi, Dad. I'm on Ancestry.com, and I need some information about our ancestors."
Wow.
I mean, for me, it was just a signal that, okay, this is right on. This is real, you know? And so we proceeded to have a conversation with that. I went back to my still point session. And in the rest of my still point session, one of the things that came to me was the scene in the Garden of Gethsemane where we're usually fed by churchianity an image of this poor, suffering fellow who is going to be beaten and bruised and take on the sins of the world as a trauma. And, you know, churchianity, many times, at least in my experience, has pounded in the, you drove in the nails, your sin caused this suffering. And what my insight was, like when I got the privilege of being able to say, yes, I'm open and I will process and I will breathe this energy of my ancestors, after I got off the phone with Michael J., I went back to breathing and I got the image of Yeshua in the Garden of Gethsemane, quote unquote, taking on the sins of the world. And it wasn't a burden. It was a privilege. It was an honor to be asked to do that. And it had nothing whatsoever to do with what followed in the way of suffering. It had to do with his arising to a new level of awareness. And, you know, when you come to the conclusion story of the whole suffering picture, we're told that what Yeshua said, and it's interesting, this particular passage, although the Greeks will say it was all written in Greek, the Greek translations even say, this is left in the original Aramaic, and the words are, not that my Aramaic pronunciation is very good, but the words were, sounded something like, Eli lama sabachthani. And we're told that he said, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Like, God's hanging on a cross, suffering, forsaken by God. Is there any universe in which that makes any sense? But in fact, what he said, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, was more like, rather than being said with dejection and trauma, was said with excitement and insight, because his personal realization was, and the words forsaken, the translation, or pardon me, the mistranslation, forsaken, the words there in Aramaic are very similar for forsaken and set aside for a special purpose. So Yeshua wasn't saying something in dejection and suffering and abandonment. With excitement, he was saying, oh, Papa, Papa, I got it. For this you reserved me. For this you set me aside. To rise to the level where I can be the space of active present love and literally take on those energetic dynamics of the world that people don't know how to do. And my take is that each one of us is invited into that place in the garden as we do our work and to process the trauma of the world. And let's get done with it. It's time.
Wow.
And each one of us, you know, where the Course says, you know, millions yet unborn will benefit from the work you do. Each one of us that takes on and does a piece of work opens an energy window for everybody on the planet who has that same energetic issue. And by you or I working through it, we literally open the energy window, not just for those people in our own family systems or bloodline with that similar issue, whether they're alive or dead, but we open the energy window for everybody on the planet with that issue.
Wow.
So I'm breathing with you and opening those spaces and hold the space for the right goals to come to mind for you to be canceling on your worksheets around what's moving with your son to clear that space. And I suspect that you or he, you know, when I think back to the conversations we've had about how sweet your relationship is with your son, I would suspect that you and or he have reached some sort of a new level of vitality to be able to allow whatever's coming up to come up. And we certainly join you in holding the space of breathing through and being able to process whatever that's about. And tie it in with the Native Americans, when they went into a sweat lodge or a healing ceremony of any kind, there was a phrase that they used, and the phrase was Matakwiasan. You know, if you were going into a sweat lodge, at the door of the sweat lodge, you would bow your head and say, Matakwiasan, which means, for all my relations. Not just doing it for ourselves, for all our relations.
I'm writing this down.
And of course, the archive will be there if you feel inclined to listen to it again. And actually, just being with that whole thing would be really powerful to just do a still point session with, just breathe and go into that and imagine that day on the floor at Heartland when you were waiting for me to show up to do energy field work on you, that you go ahead and breathe and imagine that I, even though you're there at home and I'm here, I do show up and do that energy field work on you. I will.
Okay. You mentioned the power person dynamic.
Right.
From the time he was 9 years old, I had full custody of him.
Right.
And their interactions with their dad were probably more disappointing than in Hartman's. But I suspect he has, because he lived me, he has, might have power person issues with me, don't you think?
Well, there's a good chance. Remember, three things happen that instill a power person dynamic within a child's mind, and it is usually an interaction, though not always, usually an interaction between a child and a parent. I've observed over the years that an absent parent, that children develop a powerful power person dynamic around an absent parent. And when they're under stress, their inclination is to be absent, to disappear. I was working with someone last week, and he was dealing with some abuse issues, or what he perceived as abuse between he and his spouse. And as he, you know, saw that happening, he was thinking that it was related to his relationship with his mother. But when we looked at, and the key, how you tell who your power person is in any given situation, because there can be more than one, the way you tell is, whose behavior are you doing? And what he wanted to do, you know, his mother's power person dynamic was to become physically abusive. But that wasn't what happened with him in this situation. His mind went into, well, I'm just going to go move out into the woods and live by myself. I'm going to leave. And that's exactly what his father did. So although he hardly knew his father, you know, he had shared with me previously, it's someone that I've worked with for several years, he had shared with me that, you know, his father only got out of prison to come home and abuse him and his mom, and then he'd leave again. And, I mean, he was thinking, oh, this has all got to do with mom. But it's like, well, wait a minute now. Did mom leave? No, mom was the only one that was there. Well, who left? Well, dad. Oh, bingo. And so what, under that level of stress, what his mind counseled him to do is, I got to get out of here. And, you know, in when one is ultra stressed, what happens if there's a power person dynamic in the mind is that person will do whatever it was that their power person did to them that they hated the most. And that was his dad left, abandoned him. And he wanted to abandon his wife.
Oh, gosh.
Breathing with
and
you.
And what I'm observing is that he gets upset with me about something, but he doesn't directly tell me. He just doesn't communicate.
Yeah. You know, how is his dad at communication?
Not very good.
Yeah. So probably that's the dynamic.
Yeah.
Right. So it could be a power person dynamic that involves both of you. So what I would suggest is that you might want to dig out the responsibility communication protocol and do a responsibility communication with him to work toward inviting and making the space safe. You know, one of the reasons why usually people won't communicate is because in their experience it wasn't safe to communicate. And so doing a responsibility communication exercise with him, emphasizing the safety of opening and communicating and the desirability of that, the blessing of that, might just be the thing that opens a space for him to let go of whatever the underlying dynamic is for him.
Oh, Michael, that would take so much courage. You know, all the thoughts that come up are, oh, I couldn't do it right.
Yeah. So why do you suppose you weren't very good at communicating? Oh, let me guess. Maybe it was because I won't do it right? Sounds like your worksheet work is around doing it right. And as you do the responsibility communication with him, and I'd suggest you do it in writing, I'd suggest that you share with him one of your issues is a fear that you're not going to do this right and that you're going to do it anyway because what you want to do is heal with him and have wide open, honest, true communication with him.
I'm glad you said that about writing it.
Yeah, that will give you the opportunity to do some processing, do some worksheets around what you're writing, what comes up as you're doing it, and then let that space open. And remember that the objective of communication is I have a reality in my mind that I want to transfer intact to your mind. And that reality might be, gee, son, you know, I have this reality of fear about communicating with you because I won't do it right and that I'll reinforce the separation between us rather than heal it. And so by communicating something like that and then owning it and then the invitation part of the responsibility communication tool is, remember, do you have any ideas? Do you have any support for me on how I can heal this? And from what I know of your son and what you've shared in the past, he'd probably be the first one to just rush right in and open the space to support you in your healing process. Although he has perhaps some fear and trepidation.
You're thinking about my older son.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, we've got two different sons involved. Okay. That's what I'm thinking of then. Okay.
Well, and I have this reality in my mind that he judges me against his in-laws who, you know, from the outside, daughter-in-law had a perfect upbringing. Her parents are just the kindest, sweetest people. I adore them myself. And they're not perfect. And, I carry this feeling, and I've done worksheets on it, but clearly I need to do more, that he judges me against them as the standard.
Right. And so what have you ever looked at whether or not you judge you by the standard of them or someone else?
Oh, that's a good point.
Is that projection?
Yeah, I judge myself against them. I do.
Yeah, so I'd do some worksheets around that issue and let go of that one, and that one just might open the space.
Go ahead.
And remember, the objective is to offer whatever is true in your mind, whatever your reality is, to offer it to him with responsibility and an invitation toward healing, you know, inviting, inspiring his support for your healing, whatever the issue is for you. And in that case, in the case of a parent and child, you know, often many years later, the issue can be one of, well, but of course you always blamed me. Mm-hmm. Has that ever been an issue between you of him, you blaming him?
No.
No, never.
No, I don't. No. Well, I wouldn't say never. I mean, I can't, right now off the top of my head, I can't think of what I would blame him for.
Mm-hmm. Well, why don't you ask him? Son, have you ever felt like I blamed you for anything? And see what he comes back with.
Oh, great idea.
See what he has to say. And, you know, there are two different ways that people can acquire a power person dynamic. One is directly, you know, here I am the parent and you're to look what you've done, you're to blame. That's a direct message from a power person to a child, you're to blame. But that's the active power person dynamic. But there's also a passive power person dynamic. And, you know, it'd be kind of like the reverse of what you're doing with him. That, oh, he's judging me. That would be a passive power, a passive dynamic of taking on a thought disorder of, that you think is about someone else. And so for him, a passive, you know, power person dynamic might be, well, I did this and mom, you know, stopped talking to me for a day. I concluded that she was blaming me. Now, that may not be true. But if his mind, you know, as a 5-year-old or a 10-year-old or a 20-year-old or a 2-year-old thinks, oh, mom's gone silent because she's blaming me, and seeing as how silence is a dynamic in the relationship between you now, good chance that he may have just interpreted what he considered to be your silence as blame for him. And so that would be a passive power person dynamic, a thought or disorder taken on passively. And so, you know, creating a space of safety for all of those things to be resolved is a monumental task to do within a family system.
Mm-hmm.
But it sounds like you're up for the task.
I am. I definitely am.
So,
okay, so
how about picking a number from 1 to 21?
Seven.
Seven, okay. And then a number from 1 to 13.
Five.
Okay, 7-5. So that's a mind shifter from our ever-expanding mind shifter list. So I'm going to go to section 7. I'm going to invite you to have your pen handy. So this particular mind shifter, we have a what we call an ever-expanding mind shifter list that is part of our monthly mind shifters and still point greedy group. So there are 21 sections in that list at this point, or 21 sections in that set. And the first number, 1 to 21, tells me which section to go to, and it tells me to go to section 7. And what I found, you know, if you remember when you were at Heartland, when we got people to select numbers, it always hit right on whatever the mind shifter would be, just like bingo right on. So this one just happens to be from the section Healing Generations from Jeannie's book. And 7-5 is, it is safe for me to invite. So if you've got your pen handy, 7-5 is the correct number, right?
Yep.
Okay. Yep. It is safe for me to invite the darkest parts of my family history. So 7-5 is from Jeannie's book, Healing Generations, One Breath at a Time. It's safe for me to invite the darkest parts of my family history to come to awareness and heal.
Wait. Darkest parts of my family
history. To come to awareness and heal.
Okay.
Are you breathing?
Yes, I'm breathing. I need to set aside 3 to 4 hours and keep writing.
I would say with what's going on, with being a dynamic between you and your son, that would probably be really worthwhile doing. And then once you've completed, you know, just do a brain dump on the right side of the page. And then once you've completed it, then just go back over everything you've written and look at, you know, become conscious of those thoughts that were perhaps unconscious, and then determine what work you need to do around them. You know, you might look at one and it might be, well, this is a worksheet for me. This one, I should really be doing the commitment with my son. This one, you know, that's going to be a codependence worksheet to do. So look at which of the tools you're going to use to work through whatever comes up.
Okay. 4 hours.
And Well, I think it's interesting that the context for this conversation and for you to select these two numbers just randomly out of the blue was on Friday. The question was, if I do my work, does it heal my former husband who's now passed? So I would say it's safe for me to invite the darkest parts of my family history to come forward, to come to awareness and heal, is probably about right on track for what your next piece of work is.
Yeah.
And so any support you need along the way, we're here. And we're holding the space, dear heart.
Thank you, Michael.
All right. Any other thoughts for you?
Well, I think I want to go on your website and give you all the worksheets that are available so that those are fresh in my mind.
Fresh?
When
sure.
You start this. Sure. Yeah.
Cool. Awesome.
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
So
well, we'll be holding the space. Delight to say hello.
Thank you.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye. All right, Miss Jeannie, do we have anybody else in the phone queue with a hand up or anything happening in the chat room?
No, but we did have a question from yesterday in the chat room, and we ran out of time.
Cool.
Didn't we? Yeah.
Okay.
So it was Yinka, and she said the other day that you had talked about ADHD being a defense mechanism against attack and being hypervigilant. I have a few members, and she's talking about of her book club, and friends with ADHD. I'm wondering what worksheets might be helpful for them to work on and any other information you have on ADHD.
Well, Yinka, as part of the Mind Shifters and Still Point Breathing Club, you've got the ever-expanding Mind Shifters list. So one of the first things I might suggest you do is anyone that you want to work with around that issue, that you start out by inviting them to do a Mind Shifter, explain what the Mind Shifter is, how it's used, and then invite them to pick 2 numbers, and that will take them to whatever it is that they're ready to deal with. And so that would be a starting point. And then, of course, from there, it's all of the above. I mean, it might be a codependence issue. We're looking at a power person worksheet might be appropriate, or the codependence worksheet. It might be, you know, the space to take the commitment and the mirror with myself. It might be using the commitment with someone else. It might be the forgiveness process. It might be the responsibility communication. I mean, every tool under the sun is what's designed for whatever moves for people when they're looking at something like, well, any issue, but in this case, looking at the need to be hypervigilant and therefore having trouble focusing on, you know, anything for too long a time period. And so, and assuring them of the safety of looking within and that they've got a space of support. You know, one of the reasons why, at least to me, why most people hide issues from themselves and don't deal with them is because they didn't feel safe enough at some point in their lives to look at these things. I mean, even to contemplate them. No, hold my breath, put that away, get rid of that. I don't want to look at that pain and trauma. And so creating a space of safety is like, it's safe to look, it's safe to allow things to open rather than running scared from something that we're carrying around inside of us. So the assurance of safety, the understanding of some of the principles, and then, of course, the more acquainted they become with each of the tools, the more quickly they'll work through any given issue that's ready to be processed. So that would be my offering in that regard, Yinka. And for anybody who's listening, if you're listening on one of those stations where we can't see you on our control panel, our call-in number is 563-999-3581, 563-999-3581. If you call that number, you'll be listening to the show directly on your phone. And then if you push 1, you'll raise a hand in the control panel, and Jeannie will introduce you by your phone number. So delighted that you're here. And do we have anybody with a hand up, Jeannie? Anything happening in the chat room?
No, it's all quiet. You've got 22 minutes, so you could go back to reading.
Cool, let's go for it. So we're down toward the bottom of page 34 in the Enlightenment book. And again, if you're new to the show or you've recently returned to the show, what we've been doing for a few weeks now is reading through the Enlightenment book with the objective of understanding or building the brain cells to be able to adapt or adopt the Aramaic mindset, the Aramaic way of perceiving and letting go of the Western mindset that is so just monumentally different. So it's about building the brain cells, and if you are going to do this study with us and you'd like to get a copy of the book, it's a book that's in our catalog that normally sells for $25 plus shipping. And if you want to get a copy, you know, specifically so that you can be working with it or following along with us with the radio show, rather than ordering it from our catalog and paying shipping, if you go to our website, whyagain.org, down at the bottom of the page, there's a donate button. So if you want a copy of the book and you'll donate, the book is $25. If you'll donate $26, that covers what PayPal collects from us each time that somebody makes a payment. And then we'll pay the shipping. So if you want a copy of the book, just do that. Mark in it with when you make the donation. If you go through the catalog and order it, it'll automatically add and force you to pay shipping. But we'll pick up the shipping if you want to order it by just doing that donate through the website. So we're on the bottom of page 34, and we've been talking about different words that in the Enlightenment book were left in the original language. And the reason why they were left in the original language is because there that communicated that there was a new understanding to be acquired in utilizing that particular word, that there was no corresponding word in the English language that would match up with that Aramaic word. So we are at the stage where we're looking at a symbol that's added to the text, the last paragraph on 34, and that is the Aramaic word kuba, K-H-O-O-B-A. And kuba, it turns out, is a filter or a gateway that allows only units. It's a filter over the perceptual part of the mind that allows only units of perceptual memory that are connected to or keyed to love to be used in building your mind's constructs. So it's kind of like, you know, we have this mind, and the mind can go anywhere. I mean, you've heard people make ridiculous, asinine arguments about why some of the most terrible things that have ever been done on the planet are good. You know, it's like crazy stuff. And if you really listen to that mind really believes it. And that's because that mind has no guardrails on it. And what the Aramaic, what the Aramaic teachings of Yeshua did was they gave us a set of guardrails for how to keep reason in check. Because you can bet that the guy who sold $100 million thought it was reasonable for him to do. The person who slaughtered, you know, this particular group of people, it was reasonable for them to do it. Do reasonable things. But a lot of the reasonable things people do are really insane. And the reason is because they don't have any guardrails on their minds, so they can be convinced that anything is reasonable. So remembering that there are three filters over the perceptual part of the mind in the back of the brain. One of them is kuba. One of them is fear, and one of them is hostility. If hostility is the active filter, the only quality of perceptual memory that will pass into the mind to be used for building your reality are those energies that are based in irritation. So if hostility is active, this person's going to have a perceptual construct based in threat. So hostility correlates to threat if that's the filter that's set. If fear is set, pardon me, I got that backward. If hostility is set, it's irritation. If fear is set, it's threat. So that's the quality perception someone's going to have. You know, when they said to Yeshua, how do we tell where someone's at? He said, you'll look at their fruit. If the quality of your perception is everything you look at, you're irritated. You know, we have a statement that honors that one in this culture. It's not thought of as one of the guardrails on the highway to reason, but here it is. How many times have you ever said, yeah, he got up out of, on the wrong side of the bed this morning? What does it mean? He got up with his hostility filter set. And everything he looks at seems to be the cause of irritation. Now, of course, that's all projection. The cause of irritation is the fact that in his mind is irritation. And when the hostility filter is set, the only data that his mind is able to use to build his perception will be irritation. And if the fear filter is the one that's set, then no matter who or what this person looks at, they're going to feel threatened. You know, why does a 6'5" guy who says he cherishes his spouse, who's only 5'2" and couldn't even start to threaten him, why does he raise a fist and hit her? Because his hostility or his fear filter was set. His mind was filled with irritation or threat. Not that there was any threat from her, but the actuality of the thing doesn't matter. If the mind's serving up a reality, then that's what's going to be acted upon. If Kuba is set, now again, there's no such idea expressed in, you know, any Aramaic word. If Kuba is set, then all units of perceptual memory that can be used to build the construct of the mind at the moment will be keyed to love. So we earlier talked about Rachma, which is a similar filter, a corresponding filter over the frontal lobes of the brain where intentions are stored. And these two filters, when active, were called perfect love. So this Aramaic idea of Kuba is a filter that we're told we have to have for, in Matthew 5:44, our enemies, quote unquote. The concept to be cued by Kuba did not exist in Western thought until psychological advances uncovered the controlling force of a set of mind. So this Kuba, this attitude, this mindset, which includes the desire for all-embracing affection for the other, and the cue control set, which causes what is good about the other to be perceived. So in the middle of a fit of irritation or experiencing feeling threatened from within and projecting that without, if Rachma set, even though that's activated, if one's committed to keeping that Rachma set, then one is going to go, oh, yes, and I feel some irritation moving in me, but what I know is the goodwill that I'm committed to says that I'm going to cherish and honor this person. And so this is a way to keep your mind guarded against the unresolved hostilities and fears of your family system or your culture. Wouldn't it be nice if, let's say, some of the politicians that are out there today with some of the most vile, absolute, I mean, at every turn, vile language, and people are listening to that vile language, go, yeah, man, they're great. Look how great they are. Look at that, how awesome they are. It's like, I listen to that language and I say, what? You want a mind that uses that kind of language to be in control of our laws, our country, your family? Really? That's the most bizarre thing I've ever heard. When you watch language, you're watching what's going on in someone's unconscious mind. Now, what if these minds that are playing out with this just crazy stuff were actually able to stop and go, oh, yeah, what I'm here to do is to function as the presence of love and bring love into the world. So if Rachma and Kuba are set, this cue control set causes that which is fair and just in the circumstances to come to mind and causes perception of whatever the highest and best of the wholesome desires of others are. So with Rachma and Kuba set, even though there's someone that, you know, the average person say, well, that's my enemy, if Rachma and Kuba set, I can be a space of compassion and speak to the highest and best part of them. And here's one of the things we know. This is a focal point in our Laws of Living class that comes out of this Aramaic work, and that is that a particular energy moving in one mind will tend to continue or will tend to resonate and move the same energy in another person's mind. So if somebody comes into the space with hostility going on and I'm not committed to Rachma and Kuba, they're going to tend to resonate my hostility. What am I going to do? I'm going to tend to buy into that hostility game, that fear and threat. If I have Rachma set, even if someone comes with that, I can still stop and go, you know, Bill, yesterday when I hear you're pretty upset right now, but, you know, yesterday what I heard you talking about was how much you really wanted to get this project done for your kids. And, you know, I really acknowledge you for that, and I can connect with you in that. And all of a sudden, instead of Bill's irritation about getting up on the wrong side of the bed this morning and, you know, wanting a fight. Bill goes, oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, the kids, they're really, and the whole thing is diffused. Wars can be diffused that way because a condition in one person's mind, if there is a matching potential for that energy to be moving in another person's mind, it's going to move. So when I have Rachma in Kubba, I'm going to be attuned to, and we'll get more into this when we do the Beatitudes, to just and fair behavior, and in that state have the ability to perceive what is wholesome, what is decent, what is good about that other. So the text goes on to say, being only a mindset or attitude, Kubba does not include reasoning, judgment, or action, only the controlling sets which, if sufficiently maintained, fill a memory with wholesome information and ultimately produces all-embracing love for the neighbor, for creator, and for the law upon which all hangs. So, in essence, what this does is the mindset of Rachma and Kubba creates a pathway for the essence of your being, your true human self, to stay present in your own mind and body while interacting with someone. So this is how you keep your own mind on track. Well, how do I control others? Well, you know, obviously you can't control others, but you have a powerful opportunity to influence others by maintaining those energetic patterns in yourself, which will tend, doesn't mean it's always going to happen, but will tend to resonate those higher energies in that other person's mind as well. So this is a guardrail in the mind. And it's so hugely important. I mean, imagine if the politicians that are running around puking on each other, tearing each other to bits, were like, oh, I'm here to be committed to bringing about love in my own mind and in the people around me. How different would the language be? So it's helpful to distinguish the result designated by Kubba from the energy that is indicated by the word Rachma. So these are two separate filters in the mind, one over the frontal lobes of the brain and one over the back. Rachma is that filter that allows the energy of love to come into one's physiology, and when one has that active in their minds, they will have an understanding of how the whole body of law, that is, how the way things work, hangs. You know, an understanding of that is a result of having both Rachma and Kubba, but in particular, Rachma here. So it's a condition that allows your human life love to stay present for others, no matter what they're doing. And so the result will be that love will be maintained in the presence of someone who otherwise would appear to be a threat. And you'll notice in you know, the next edition we'll be changing this, because there's been a real metamorphosis in our understanding over the last few years of the word love, where the error of thinking of love as the way our culture thinks of it is something we're going to do, something we're going to get, something we're going to give. And so this was written when that understanding was not as refined as it is now. So it will be added in the next version of the text. Be used only to represent, or to be used only as a word that represents human life, represents the truth of who we are as human beings, not to represent something we're going to do to somebody else, something we're going to give to something else, someone else, or something we're going to get from someone else. So there's a correction there. So while Rothman works in concert with Kuba, that mindset of love, the presence of love represented by Rothman now brings in reason, thoughts, judgment, and behavior. If one is successful in maintaining Rachma for all men, Kuba, the all-embracing presence of love, the ability to keep your human life present for all others, will develop. With Rachma, the unique fact that Will Rogers never met a man that he did not like ceases to be unique because it becomes a natural result anyone can reach. If one maintains a mindset of Rachma and Kuba, the two together were what was called perfect love, then the achievement of that mindset will be continuous, and cue controls then will fill one's memory, perception, reason, and judgment with what is good and honorable about others until the all-embracing presence of love is established. So to carry around or to be carried around in a mind that holds no energy that can obliterate the presence, the awareness of the presence of yourself as active love becomes one of the objectives here. To have a mind that can support that. And why is that not common in our culture? The words don't even exist in the English language or the Latin language or the Greek language. There is no such idea. You know, we hear all these different words. Oh, the Greeks had this word and that word and that word, all these different words for love. Filial love, you know, Philadelphia, brotherly love. But there's no such concept as Rachma and Kuba. Are literally, when active, the gateways that allow you and I to maintain the awareness of ourselves as the presence of love and to bring that presence of love fully active into our minds, into our perception, and into our interactions with others. Under the ancient Aramaic understanding, the mindset Kuba produces a particular quality of judgment regarding another. Under modern understanding, it appears to do so by controlling present perception and the stocking of memory. In other words, what data is allowed to be used by memory informing one's perception. On the issue of how should I act, in response to the question, how do I work with this person, Kuba, or how should I act toward this person, Kuba produces the answer of kenuta, another word that was left in the Aramaic, which is justly and fairly. In response to this, the question, how do I work with this person, Kuba produces the answer of humility. And humility, as opposed to the Greek idea of humility, is this grovel in the earth like a worm because you're lower than a snake's belly, is transformed into recognizing that I have a mental ability to see what is good and wholesome about others and their objectives. So that's humility. It's not about groveling. It's about having your own mindset so that you can see what's good and wholesome about another. And, you know, it may be something that's minimized in someone, but if you have that fully active in yourself, literally, you will resonate the next deeper level of that possibility within everyone that you interact with. And that's what transforms the world. And so we're down to our last few seconds, and so I'm just going to say thank you, everybody, for joining us. Create the best year yet of your eternal life. It's an awesome gift to give the world. Joining you in living a life where Rachma and Kuba are natural conditions in your mind. Blessings. Take care. Bye-bye.